Professor Bruce McGraw, and we will talk about some philosophical issues, and I believe we will have a kind of focus on his book, which is The Magical Universe. We want to offer to the people some new theory, some new point of view, something new that Bruce believes that he believes that Americans need to do in order to pass through this challenging times. Welcome back, Bruce. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. So, as we talked before, you told me that you think that we as humanity and as Americans right now, we still see others as we versus them. So we don't, instead of like treating other people as just we are all us, we are all humans, we live in the same planet. And I think this virus is also a good example of how we are interconnected in all what we are going through. How can we teach people to stop thinking about other people as something different or something that they see as an opponent, and without losing their comfort zone? Because I really have a comfort zone.
They may lose their comfort zone. That's part of, you know, when you grow, that's part of it. You have to be willing to lose your comfort zone.
Okay.
So you can't really grow unless you lose your comfort zone. You know, Plato talked about the journey out of the cave, and you know, there's certain points where, you know, down in the cave when you're tied up and you can just see the wall and you think that's reality, and then somebody releases you and you turn around and you see that the figures on the wall, the shadows on the wall, were actually created by figures behind a fire. And then it's like, you don't see clearly. You it's hard for you to take that in. You don't understand it. And so I think part of growing is you have to be willing to go through this discomfort, this chaotic state of mind where you don't really know what's up, what's down, what's right, what's left. You have to be willing to go through that before you can get new ideas. So I think if your main aim is to hang on to your comfort zone, I think you can't grow that. So I think part of that is people have to be willing to step outside their comfort zone, you know. And anytime you do anything new, you always have to sort of step outside your comfort zone and try something new. And so I think that's part of it. So I think you have to be willing to step outside your comfort zone. So yeah. I think that's the first thing you have to be willing to do.
So that's the essential step that every person should. I mean, there is something that some philosophers like Walter Kaufman calls the decidophobe. I mean, they have a fear of taking decisions. And I think that's why many people voted for Trump. I mean, if they were believing in your point of view, I mean, if they saw like other people as, okay, they have a different color, different religion, but they are still humans like me. So I think they would have not voted for Trump if they believed in your philosophy, right?
I would think not, no.
Okay.
I would think they'd all see Trump as, and if they didn't, they certainly would now. Definitely.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of that change comes from also from like personal experience. You know, when you see something like the killing of George Floyd,
yeah,
and the horrific way it was done, you know, and to see that video over and over again, you know, I think it had a big effect on people. And sometimes when we see something like that it can completely change us. You know, it could, that some kind of a powerful emotional experience when you watch that can be enough to change somebody's thinking. You know, every once in a while I've read about certain white racists who have killed a black person and they get caught and they're brought in there, and you know, it doesn't happen for all of them, obviously, but some of them have a moment, you know, where they go up, they break down in front of the young man's mother and apologize because, you know, they've had a realization. Somehow their closed upness, they're seeing black people as different and separate, and for some reason the pain of the mother or something broke through that armor and they change and they become a different person. And you know, those things can happen, but we don't always have that kind of an experience. And you know, but if we're willing, and through, I would say, through meditation and you know, reading different ideas, especially things we don't agree with necessarily, but are intellectually challenging, that can also lead us to change. So I think there's, you know, a lot of different ways people can have that change.
So do you believe that humanity ever will be able to, like, not need like a foreign supernatural being to take care of us from outside, but rather go inside, like that there was a Sufi Muslim, his name was Ibn Arabi in Arabic. So he believed, like Spinoza, that God and the universe are one thing. So God is within everything, like not just us, but
right,
even the wind. Yeah. So I think that you are very close to Ibn Arabi in this sense, that you see that we should believe that spirituality is here, right here. It's not out there, right? Is that
right?
What are you trying to tell us?
Yeah, I mean, Jesus himself said, you know, the kingdom of God is within.
Yes.
And so, you know, he said it there. And he also said, you know, the kingdom of God is spread out before us, but we don't have eyes to see.
Yes.
And so, you know, when I talk about the magical universe and I give this new creation story, it's basically the old creation story. I use the scientific Big Bang theory, basically. But if you look at it with different eyes, you can see the magic in the whole creation story. It's there. You just have the eyes to see it. And so part of my purpose in writing, going through the creation story, and as I think you mentioned before, I have my shorter version, The Magical Universe, where I touch on it a little, I go into a little bit, but not as much as I do in the longer version, New Mythology. But, you know, I go through these different miracles, and I call them miracles. And I think, you know, if people read that with new eyes, they can see the miracles and they can feel the miracles. And, you know, every time I study these things, how the universe is constructed and how it was made and how it was created and how it's grown sort of organically up to us, to humans, it just fills me up with a sense of awe and wonder. And it's just completely mind blowing. And, you know, you try to understand it with your brain, you do the best you can to understand it, but it's too much. And you just have to sit back and wonder at the miraculous nature that we're even sitting here and all the things that led us up to being right here.
Yeah.
And that's not even bringing in all the quantum physics, which is, you know, not even the quantum physics this can explain. So it's just, you know, it's a magical universe, and yeah, we just have to have the eyes to see it. So part of my book is to help people to begin to see that.
Yes. So you are trying to bring the soul and the body together in one philosophy, because I know throughout the history of philosophy, there was always realism versus idealism, this kind of struggle, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Let me ask you this question. You stated that on your website, it got my attention where he says it was as if the universe had planned it all along. How is that different from Hegel's soul or Spinoza's universe? And if you agree with those two philosophers, can we end up with strong centralized state? I mean, because Hegel was one of the leading philosophers, like Kant, who made Germany end up with a strong centralized or kind of dictatorial power. Can we avoid dictatorship? Because that's exactly what Americans are, especially on the Republican side, they're claiming that they're afraid of that. So what do you think?
And they're going to create it in their fear of it, right?
Okay, yeah,
dictatorship,
exactly.
Out of their fear of a dictatorship.
Yes.
To prevent a dictatorship.
Yes.
Yeah. I would agree. You know, there are definitely aspects of the magical universe, new mythology of Hegel. I think one of the biggest things is that evolution goes through these stages. So I do agree with that. Yeah. And I think there's definitely agreements with, you brought up Spinoza? Did you bring up Spinoza?
Yeah.
Or just,
yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and then Spinoza, I think, just because my understanding of Spinoza is that his understanding was more of a pantheist, that everything's sort of interconnected.
Yes.
And so I think there's definitely that too. But I think the difference with Hegel is that for Hegel, this growth and evolution of the universe comes to an end.
Yes.
You know, his idea, he never used these terms, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. He talked about triads instead. But I think, you know, a lot of people apply that to them. So, you know, basically you have a status quo. A thesis is sort of like the status quo, which goes along fine. And then there's an antithesis that gets developed, like problems start to occur in the status quo. And, you know, there's a rebellion against it. And the two sides are at polar opposites. But then, you know, the notion is wiser minds prevail. And, you know, because even though the status quo has a lot of problems, there's still some good things you want to preserve from the status quo. And while the antithesis could be going to extremes, too far to extremes, there's still some good things in the antithesis that we need to incorporate into the status quo. So eventually wiser minds or something come together and they synthesize the best of both sides. And we get a new synthesis, which takes us up to the next stage of evolution. And then that new synthesis becomes the new thesis. And then an antithesis develops and a new synthesis. And every time it gets higher and higher. But for Hegel, there's a final synthesis where, you know, Geist, which is the spirit or God, I mean, it's the whole reason this thing is created, this whole universe is created, so Geist can, God, it's a little different vision of God, but yes, that Geist can understand who he is. So he's going through these stages of history to understand, get a better understanding of who he is. So at each new stage, he's reached a new level of understanding of who he is. And then in the final synthesis, he has complete absolute knowledge, self-realization. And the thing about Hegel, and I think would lead to this kind of dictatorship almost, is that Hegel, because that's when everything stops. And so Hegel thinks it all stopped and that Geist uses human beings as pawns for its self-realization. And so Hegel, not immodestly, believed that Geist used his brain to have this final understanding and realization. So Hegel saw the final vision. Well, I don't think that's the final vision. That's the thing. I know. I think he just became maybe a synthesis that became the next thesis. And so if you look at things evolutionary-wise, you know, to me, the antithesis to Hegel's system, this rational system, where human beings are just pawns, ends up becoming the existentialist, and especially Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, you know, who critiqued Hegel's system and said, you know, what about me? Where do I fit into this system? Am I just a pawn? Well, I don't feel like a pawn. I feel like a human being, you know, who has my own wants and desires and needs. You know, where does me as an individual fit into this? I'm not just some kind of pawn of some higher force. And so that was sort of the antithesis. Hegel's got this system that sort of, in some sense, denies the individual ultimately is just a pawn of Geist to understand himself.
Yes.
And then Kierkegaard's out there going, no, individuals matter. They're not just pawns. And so that leads to, I think the Romantics sort of sought that, but especially the existentialist philosophers rebelled against that, which created the thing. And to me, when you take the best of that rebellion and the system, you have a new synthesis, which to me is where what I would call the integral philosophy, or the magical universe, new mythology comes in, as it integrates that. And so I don't know if this thing has an end. You know, we don't know. We don't know where it's going. We just know that right now human beings are the, as far as we know, the highest, most intelligent creatures that have evolved yet.
Yes.
And it's still going on, though, and we need to evolve, because clearly all these problems are being caused by the fact that human beings' levels of consciousness are not at a stage where we can solve these problems yet, and we need to get to a higher state to really solve these problems. But is that higher state even the final? I don't know. Maybe there's higher states. You know, we think of people like Jesus or Buddha or Socrates or some of these people maybe embodying these higher states, but I don't know if that's the final state. You know, it's too much. Yeah. And, you know, we think about 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs became extinct. And so they were the dominant species on the planet then, although there were mammals running around, but were sort of suppressed by the dinosaurs. But if you think about it, you know, the dinosaurs had no conception of where evolution was going to go 65 million years later.
Yes.
What dinosaur could imagine human beings? And yes. So you think right now, if we continue to evolve, where will we be in 65 million years? Now, yes. A lot of people, when I talk about evolution, they'll think, well, physically, they always think about physical evolutions, you know, like, well, maybe our little toe will disappear and, you know, things like that. But I'm talking about, because now it's all about evolution of consciousness. And so, as I said previously, you know, human beings are going through these stages of evolution of consciousness. And so I think that's where it's going. But how high and how far those evolutionary stages of consciousness, I have no idea. It's a mystery. You know, so I think in the end, we just have to be in awe at the mystery. And I think the real key of the magical universe is we have to enjoy being in the mystery. And we can't be afraid of the mystery. We can't be afraid of not having all the final answers or maybe even any answers, ultimately.
Yes.
But we just have to enjoy the mystery. And, you know, Socrates defined wisdom as the one who is wise is he who knows he doesn't know anything really profound and beautiful. So it's almost like when we're younger, we start to think we know everything.
Yes.
And then as we develop and grow, we slowly realize everything we thought we knew isn't true.
Yes.
And we drop those things, at least as absolute beliefs. And pretty soon we realize we can't really know anything really beautiful and profound, but we can experience it.
Yes.
And so I think we move on to deeper and deeper levels of experience. And, you know, what that looks like, you know, I mean, you can only really relate it to one's own experience. And how deep, you know, how deep do those experiences go? Is there a limit to them? I have no idea. It's, in a sense, it doesn't even matter. Because the whole thing is to have that experience, to have those experiences. And so I think, you know, when you balance the system, which I think, you know, the right Hegelians took to create the dictatorship in Germany because he thought he had reached the end, but you move in with the individuality, the focus on individuality of the existentialist and the romantics, and then you combine them both, you get a system, but a system that Alan Watts talked about having leaky edges. You know, it's like you put it out there, but it's not as firm as like Hegel's final answer. It's out there as I think guideposts that give us an idea of where things are going, but there's no absolutes. And, you know, everybody has to sort of see this for themselves. And I think we're at a point where of society where we have to hope enough people reach this kind of higher level of thinking and experiencing life to save the planet. Because I think, you know, we're right on the brink of losing the whole thing here. But, you know, it's catastrophes that bring about the biggest changes, that force us to go deeper in ourselves, to get deeper understandings, and more profound changes happen when in catastrophes than they do when things are smooth and everything's going calm, and you know, we can get lazy then and not feel like we need to do anything. Catastrophes bring the best out of us, or they can at least. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, sure. You have more than enough. I mean, that was really a good answer to hear, because you went into detail here. You just brought into my mind when I was a student at the university. I took a class in ethics, and one of the topics was that ethics are relative, so each culture sees its own values as perfect and ethical and so on and on. But then I challenged my professor. I told her, okay, imagine, and I am an immigrant, so nobody tell me, please, that I'm a xenophobe, because I'm myself an immigrant. Anyway, I told my professor that, okay, imagine somebody coming from a culture where they see it very normal to hit a woman, for example, or to commit violence against homosexuals or like any person who is different. So I still feel that, even though after I became an atheist, I feel that we need some absolute truths. So I need to believe in something absolute in order for me to make sense in this of this world. Because if I don't have any absolutes at all, then, well, I mean, even the most evil person would be, okay, irrelevant. Like Adolf Hitler would become, he was just doing what nature was doing. But I know that I should believe in some absolutes. So,
you know, do you believe in absolutes? Are there any absolutes you believe in?
Yeah. So one of the absolutes I believe in, for example, that I should be free, for example. And since I should be free, I believe that everybody should be free. If I don't believe in freedom, for example, then I cannot even speak what in my mind. And I believe that everybody should be free. So what do you think about the struggle between freedom and equality? Because as you know, there are on the contradiction sides, you know, like Republicans argue for liberty, but I know sometimes they mean to undermine equality. And Marxism undermined liberty for the sake of equality. So how do you solve this issue in your philosophy?
Well, you know, some people talk about political equality, which I guess in some sense we're supposed to have in the West. You could argue that we do or we don't because of the influence of money, but at least up to now, we thought at least everybody had the chance to vote. But now if all the voter suppression, you know, even that's becoming an issue, it's become a big issue in this level. But the idea, I mean, ideally, political equality means we all get to speak our minds freely, which I think is sort of what you're referring to.
Yes.
That we have that kind of freedom. But then there's also economic equality. And so that seems to be the area where the West has fallen. And I think you kind of rightfully pointed out that's something the Marxists point out. And I would say, you know, and again, you know, we have to think about this, but that, you know, I think everybody, at least in my view, everybody should be taken care of to the sense that they should have a certain basic level of food, clothing, and shelter. And no matter what you are, everybody is entitled to that. And then beyond that, I think, you know, we have to have what I would call equal opportunity. So everybody has to have an equal shot. And, you know, in our society, we don't really have that, because we know the wealthiest people who come from the better families go to the better schools, they get into the better colleges. Even if the grades are not that good, they can somehow, through influence of their father or donations to universities, they can get in where maybe even brighter people who come from lower income levels don't have that same opportunity. So we don't really have that kind of opportunity, equal opportunity. So I would say, you know, if we're having a race, everybody should start on the same yard goal line, and they're going to run 100 yards, they have to start in the same place. But it seems like the way we have it is, you know, some people are on the goal line, some people are starting at the 50-yard line, they only have to run 50 yards, and then they score the touchdown, they run their 50 yards, and then they say, hey, I beat you, you know, you had to run 100 yards, but I had all these head starts, so it kind of puts me up at the 50-yard line, so look at me, how come you can't work as hard as me? Well, I think we don't have equal starts in life. So I think that need, it's never going to be completely equal, but I think it needs to be balanced out more. So I think we need to have some level of combination of economic and political equality. And, you know, John Rawls, who's a political philosopher, he came up with this idea that, you know, this theory of justice is that, you want to know what the true rules of justice are? Imagine you're creating a society and you don't know where your place is and that society is going to be yet. It's sort of just out there. And let's say you're going to be born into a society, but you don't know whether you're going to be born a man or a woman. You don't know what race you're going to be born in. You don't know what kind of level of IQ you're going to be born with. You don't know how smart you're going to be. You don't know, you know, if you're born in a richer family or a poorer family, a good family or a bad family, you don't know if you're going to be born handicapped. You don't know anything. You know nothing about yourself. So let's say you could be born in any number of infinite number of possibilities. So if you had no idea where you were going to be born in that society, what would be the rules you would set up in that society? You know, so sitting on the outside, you'd think if you had no idea where your position was going to be, you'd probably set up a rule where even if kind of the worst imaginable outcome came for you, that all the bad things happen that you wouldn't want to happen to you in your life, you'd say, well, I want to create a society where at least no matter what happens where I am, I'm going to be able to have a decent life. I mean, you think you'd want to do that because you don't know where you're going to be and you could be in a terrible situation. So you want to say, if I'm in this situation, I want to at least know I'm going to have a good life. And so you'd probably create rules that were much more towards fairness and equality and justice. I mean, you could say, you know, winner take all, this kind of thing. But, you know, what are the chances that you're going to actually be part of the 1, 2, 3%, even the top 10% of the society? You know, you only have a 10% chance, 90% chance you're not going to be there. Why would you take the roll the dice and hope you would be one of those when you may be likely somewhere else? So it would seem to me, you know, from that point of view, you'd want to create a much more egalitarian society. And that would force people to look at things in a much more global perspective rather than an individual perspective, because most of us are in a place in a society. And so then we want to support things that are going to benefit us in our place in society. So people don't have much, you know, want to pass laws where they can get more help, and people have a lot, you know, often don't want to help people who don't have so much. So they want to pass laws that, you know, don't give people that kind of money and opportunity because they don't need it themselves. But if they didn't know they were going to be there, they might have a totally different point of view. So, you know, I think that's an interesting thought experiment to do, to try to come up with, you know, what should be the rules of society towards fairness and equality and economic opportunity, and how should we set it up? As one kind of form we could use to begin to come up with kind of sort of, I don't particularly like the word absolute, but as rules or guidelines in society about how society should be run.
Well, yeah, I agree with you that even absolute truths should be, put under investigation, like we philosophically put them in under question. Okay, but before I,
But you know, we can never know absolute truths because it's kind of like knowing God. So it's sort of, you know, it's kind of, again, you know, when Plato talks about his journey out of the cave, let's say to understand the concept of justice, I don't think anybody ever gets the perfect understanding of justice. That's why Socrates is knowing nothing, you know, admitting that you know nothing is the sign of wisdom. Because we never get there. We can get closer and closer and closer to deeper and deeper understandings of what justice is, but we never have the absolute knowledge of justice. Yes. It's always a little bit more. So part of, you know, when Socrates carried on these dialogues, I think it was not only to help educate other people, but he was also looking to educate himself and get deeper and deeper understandings. And, you know, I think any kind of true teacher is teaching not only to help educate students, but he's looking for students to give him more insights.
Yeah, but
let me his understanding also.
Let me ask you, do you have doubts that you exist, for example? Because I know for sure that I exist. I mean, I feel my arms, my head, my feelings. When I am angry, I am the person who feels angry.
I guess you could say, you know you exist, but I guess you could ask, what is it that's existing?
Yes.
What is it existing? Is it your body's existing? When you say I exist, what do you exactly mean? I mean, what is existing?
I feel pain. I mean, that's an example. Yeah.
You know you exist if you feel pain, but if you don't feel pain, exist?
That's challenge too, of course. I mean,
course, quantum physics has come along and sort of, I think, pretty much dispelled materialism, because quantum physics tells us, you know, all this stuff that we seem so material is made up of these atoms that we once thought were these hard little solid, like billiard balls or BBs or something.
Yes.
And then we find out now through quantum physics that atoms are, you know, like 99.999999% empty space. So there's really no materiality anywhere. So this thing we call a body, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of an illusion that we see it as a body, because it's not really what it is. It's not solid. It just appears solid to our eyes, because that's how we're wired right now, I think. We couldn't really handle the fact that reality would start to lose its solidity and maybe get a little wavy and shaky and things like that, you know, and people who have taken different psychedelic drugs like LSD or something, you know, sometimes reality can get kind of hazy and shaky and less material. And, you know, we don't have the framework in our brain to process that kind of information. Yes. You know, so our brain, I think, limits sensory input into our senses to what we can handle, what we can intellectually categorize. And so, you know, it's like I spent some time in India, and, you know, in Calcutta, and, you know, in the middle of the noisy streets and the chaos and everything of Calcutta, you know, people would be bringing their horse-drawn carts or, you know, through the streets, or maybe even pulled by a donkey or something, but they put blinders on the donkeys or the horses, because if they saw all the chaos, they would freak out. It would be too much. So they put the blinders on and they lead them through to negate their sensory input. And so evidently just hearing it, but not seeing it being led, they're okay. They've reduced enough sensory input that they can walk calmly through all this noise and traffic. But if you take those blinders off, it's too much sensory input and they freak out. And I feel like, you know, we have this sensory, we have these filters on us in the same way. And so we filter out what comes in that we can categorize. And, you know, sometimes we take certain psychedelic drugs, it can lift up some of those filters, and a little more reality than we're accustomed to can come in. And if we're not ready for it, it can be a kind of an unsettling experience, just to say that.
Yes.
So what is this? That's why I say, you know, what is it? Who is it that is feeling pain? Or what is it that's feeling pain and has those senses? You know, who is feeling that? That, I think, would be your question to get down to, when you get down to do you exist, and what are we existing in? I mean, if our body is, it means the whole world in some sense is non-material too, even though we see it as material. So what is it? What is that we're really living in anyway? You know, the Hindus called it Maya, you know, illusion. And it doesn't necessarily mean nothing's there, but we just don't see it in its true nature.
Yes.
And that's sort of what evolution of consciousness is, to kind of lift those veils and those filters so we can see more and more deeply into it. So you wonder, you know, for example, when the Buddha became enlightened, you know, I wonder, how did he see all of this stuff? Through what eyes did he see that? So
cool.
That's still another way to think about it. So what is, we have to say, what is this I anyway?
Cool. I enjoyed this
conversation. And I hope to see you next time. You opened for us some other topics that we can discuss in future, especially like, can we create superhumans? Like, is it wrong to create superhumans? Or
I don't know. That sort of gives that idea, like,
yes,
somebody is outside is going to create them, like you're going to make them, like you make something in a shop, you know.
Yes.
You can't make the superhuman. It's something that each individual has to attain.
Yes.
On their own. You know, Nietzsche talked about the evolution that we needed to evolve into the next stage, and he called that the new human, you know, the Übermensch.
Yes.
Which is the next stage in human evolution. And Übermensch in German just means overcoming. And so Nietzsche didn't think we had a real self, but we have continuing selves. And so the idea of the Übermensch is he's always able to overcome whatever his self, you know, if his self that he's created gets in the way of his growth and development, he has to overcome that. He has to be able to overcome that and throw that away. Yes. And so he's always creating anew. And so I think that's part of if you're talking about kind of evolving human beings, you know, we have to not get stuck in our ideas. We have to be willing to always make ourselves anew. And Nietzsche actually talked about, you know, that these selves, which are really kind of world perspectives that we have in a particular self, we have different world perspectives with different selves, that they were like, we try them on like clothes, you know, like we go to a store, we get clothes, see which one we look best in, and we buy those. So we do the same things, world views, perspectives, we can try on different ones, we find which one fits best. And, you know, you find out which one fits best because it allows you a lot of freedom to grow and develop, and you know, you feel more content, you feel happier, you feel more creative. And then after a while, maybe that self gets too constrictive, and all of a sudden, you know, it seems to be blocking further development. Then each day you have to get rid of it. You have to go out and find another self. You have to find another worldview that opens up more possibilities for you. So if you're having problems, you know, the problem isn't the world out there, the problem is the world in here, and that's what we can work on. And each individual has to work on that, you know, themselves, to always be self-overcoming. And it, you know, it's hard. But you have to keep doing it. It's like you do it one time, you have this aha moment, you go, oh wow, I really see it now. Well, that's just like another, you know, it's great, and maybe it'll last for a while. But, you know, it can, after a while, if you don't keep renewing that vision, it'll get stale and you got to keep moving on. It's a continual process. I don't know. I don't think, you know, you talk about, does it have an end? I don't know if it has an end. I think you have to keep moving.
Going forward.
Okay. Yeah.
It was great seeing you, Russ. And yeah. I believe that I will see you again. See you then.